This is the MedicCast, May 19th, 2008. Happy EMS week, folks.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters.
This is the MedicCast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to the MedicCast. This is episode 118. I'm Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and I'd like to welcome everybody to the show. If you are a brand new listener, welcome to the MedicCast. I hope you enjoy what you're listening to here. I urge you to head over to MedicCast.com, check out the links there for the MedicCast show notes, and find the blog, and you will find all the information there, links to everything I talk about in this podcast, as well as links to subscribe to the show, and also how you can get the show downloaded and brought to you free by email, and check out the other episodes in the past and use the MedicCast as the tool it is intended to be to raise your EMS practice to another level. Of course, for all of you long-term listeners and contributors to the show, and boy, there's been a lot of contributors to the show this past week, I just want to thank all of you for your continued assistance, for your suggestions, your comments, and your questions and corrections. All of those things are what make this such a great community effort here at the MedicCast, and I'm happy and proud to be able to help serve that community here on the show. So, thank you very much. If you'd like to contribute yourself, you can do so in a bunch of different ways. First of all, email me at podmedic@mac.com. You can also call into the voicemail line 941-306-3342, 941-30-MEDIC, and you can also contribute over at the MedicCast forums. If you haven't already checked out the MedicCast forums, you can get there by going to forums.medicast.com, and you will find a great selection of different conversations and suggestions and all kinds of links and information over there at the MedicCast forums. Recent posts by a large number of people. Listener Paul is contributing over there, as well as Medic One, and 0311 Doc is just really put up a lot of different information, especially a recent number of posts talking about a tactical combat medic program that is being supported by the U.S. military, and a great discussion there that'll go along with this past week's special MedicCast Live interview, which you can find out more about later in the show. Also, information on what we should be doing about combining recertification efforts, international recruitment of paramedics and EMTs to other countries, and even information and responses to some of the articles I've posted on new protocols. So head over to the MedicCast forums. It's free to join, free to participate. You can contribute articles, your own comments and suggestions to other people's posts, and photographs and videos all over at the MedicCast forums at forums.medicast.com. Since we're on the topic of listener contributions to the MedicCast, I'll jump on into a look at some of the great emails I got this week. I got an email from listener Michael contributing and talking about a recent discussion I had on different mobile training centers and simulators that are out there, and he wanted to point out that the University of Iowa has a mobile training center that travels around the state to different agencies. It is the only one of its type in Iowa, featuring a realistic ambulance setting, and it is all built within a 40-foot motorhome, and it goes out and provides emergency medicine education to all kinds of providers, both EMTs, paramedics, as well as physicians and nurses, and it's a pretty interesting look at that. I will try to post up a link in the show notes, or maybe I'll post up a link in the MedicCast forum for this. Look for a forum link on training simulators. I also got an email in from a longtime listener, Kelly, and contributor to the show in many different ways. Kelly was commenting on a recent part of the discussion over at the Stump the Pod Medic episode over at MedicCastLive.com. And the MedicCast Live is a great place for you to check in periodically. I am going to be doing more and more live recordings over there, basically recordings of interviews and things that I set up with different movers and shakers in the industry. And segments from those interviews may show up as part of the MedicCast from time to time, as well as being broken down and used as additional content to help out those that are subscribers over at the MedicCast Extra site. But in the meantime, you can check out some of those articles and particular recordings over at the MedicCast Live. Kelly was talking about a discussion that I had on the Stump the Pod Medic show about ALS providers working and training BLS providers. And it's one of those things I feel very strongly about. In fact, if you've listened to the show ever, you probably have heard me talk about my feelings regarding making sure that your EMTBs help you out and know what to do to assist you as an ALS provider. Nothing we do is sacred or secret or needs to be kept from the rest of our working community. Anything we can do to increase the education level and the competency of all of our providers in a variety of skills is a great way to help us treat those critical patients in those instances when we need that extra pair of hands. And so I always try to train BLS providers to assist me in doing things like placing electrodes for regular EKGs or 12-lead EKGs, assisting me in getting IV bags set up and ready to flow. All of these things can be done and assisted with by competent and well-trained EMTBs. And this is the way you help get that extra pair of hands in place when you need them for those critical patients when things are going downhill fast. You'll be glad you took the time to include them in the process. And Kelly, thank you for your comments and suggestions on this particular topic. I also heard from listener Rob, and Rob recently asked to be added as a friend over in MySpace. If you head over to MySpace, you can actually find me under the term PodMedic there. So you can find me there as well as at Facebook under PodMedic. So head over and check all of that out. If you'd like to be added as a friend in either of those locations, you can get that done. Rob was telling me about his time working in the Portland area, and he was riding on some calls with another ambulance service. Got a chance to work with some of the providers in this other service and got to talk up the MedicCast with them. They had never heard of the show, didn't know that it existed, and he was able to share the MedicCast with some other people that he was working with. And you know what, Rob? First of all, I just want to thank you very much. That's one of the best ways to talk up the show and get the word about the MedicCast out there. But it's also an indication that I need to remind everybody that that's something we can do. There are a lot of EMS providers out there, and believe me, I have a lot of listeners, but I can tell you that nowhere near even a small percentage of the total number of EMS providers are listening to the MedicCast. So you can get out there and share the MedicCast with the people you know. Not only that, but if you're active in an online web forum for EMS medical providers or maybe even nursing providers, you can point them to the MedicCast network shows like the MedicCast or the Nursing Show. You know, if you find a recent article that you like, go ahead and link to it in your forum post, or go ahead and put it up on your blog if you have your own blog. If you have an EMS blog or one that you read a lot and it's not already listed in my links and blog role on the left-hand side of the MedicCast, you want to go ahead and let me know about it so I can add it to the MedicCast blog and show notes pages. And that's the best way we can do to support each other by getting some of that link traffic out there. Every time you guys post a link back to my show, it actually increases the references via search that I get, and that helps somebody else find the MedicCast, believe it or not. When they search for EMS podcast or paramedic podcast or EMT podcast, you can give them a better opportunity to find the MedicCast by linking back to me in your forum posts and your blog posts. Now, don't be crazy about it and don't be obnoxious about it. If you have a real article that you'd like to contribute and link to, do that. If you like a particular episode of the show, link to the show notes on that show. That's the best way to point people in my direction and help support the MedicCast and continue to help it grow. So I want to thank Rob for contributing in that regard on his behalf, and also urge the rest of you to get out there and support the MedicCast in all of the many ways that you can do so. It's time now to jump on into this week's news, and let's take a look at a couple of different things this week that kind of caught my eye. First off, the United States has been trying for some time to put together some kind of a national emergency communications network, some way for all of us to communicate with each other in the event of a natural disaster or terrorist attack or some other issue. This came out of the 9/11 report that agencies could not speak effectively and communicate together. And so when one agency called for people to remove themselves from a dangerous situation, other involved agencies did not get the information. And so this has been something that's been addressed and batted around. There was some discussion recently on including it in the recent bandwidth purchase that occurred with the old analog television bandwidth, but that didn't seem to pan out. Well, the FCC, Federal Communications Commission, has agreed to try again to work on creating a nationwide emergency communications network, and they are looking for a way to attract private investors into this program and get some kind of support in the private sector to help support that. Now, the recent selling or bidding process that occurred for the analog television bandwidth raised a record $19.1 billion in private sector investment. However, there was no interest in the minimum $1.3 billion bid set aside for a public safety network. And the way that would set up would be they would invest in the public safety network. They would get an equal amount of bandwidth to use for their own wireless purposes if they would assist in the development of a nationwide wireless networking system. And, you know, that seemed like a good deal to me, but apparently they would rather spend $19.1 billion on their own network and then spend more money on building their own infrastructure and not have anything to do with assisting the public safety network. And you know what my feeling is on that, folks? The U.S. government just auctioned off public bandwidth owned by the taxpayers to private companies, and those private companies were not required to give anything back to the public. And my feeling on that is, you guys want access to this stuff, you better pony up and start supporting emergency services in this country. And how hard is it to add in transmission capability across your network that allows agencies to talk and interact together in a true nationwide EMS and fire and public safety communications network? And so I think, you know, you're spending $19.1 billion plus the cost of adding your own infrastructure on top of it, another however many billions of dollars. I think the requirement should have been there that they go ahead and support a national communication system. And I think that was in the original proposal, but strangely enough, they were able to lobby and get it removed because of the increased cost burden it would place upon them. And yet they had no problems bidding up the price so high. So apparently money wasn't the factor. I'm sorry, I feel a little strongly about this. I think that the government has been way too business friendly recently and hasn't done much to give anything back to the rest of us in exchange for being business friendly. All right, folks, I'll get off my soapbox and move on into the next news story. The next two items actually in the news are going to be featuring some lawsuits involving paramedics, either the paramedics suing somebody or somebody suing the paramedics, as is the case in the first story. This is an interesting story coming out of Florida, and it's looking at an emergency room physician who is suing EVAC paramedics, EVAC paramedics in the Daytona Beach area, after they brought a near-drowning victim into the emergency department and then transferred on their own initiative that patient to another emergency department. They're citing that the physician did not let them transfer the patient to the hospital and never adequately reviewed or initially assessed that patient at all. And after spending 13 minutes waiting with a near-drowning victim, in fact, an 8-year-old child near-drowning victim, they on their own initiative took that child to another hospital. Now, that's their story. The physician says that he did assess the patient, determined the patient was stable, and in fact was on the phone preparing to initiate transport to another hospital when the paramedics left on their own. Now, interestingly enough, the hospital assessed the situation and determined that the physician, in fact, violated local law hospital policy and federal law when he did not adequately assess that patient and was fired from his job. And that's what he's suing for, is the damages related to that. This is interesting, and I think it's something that says a lot about being a patient advocate. If you think your patient isn't getting adequate care or getting adequate attention when you get to a facility, you need to do something about it. And that may involve taking them to another facility. Now, this is a big step, and I'm not advocating doing that in any but the most extreme circumstances, and you really need to adhere to your own protocols. This certainly would require, in my estimation, a call to a supervisor or a controlling dispatch agency and letting them know that the hospital is not prepared to treat a patient in the manner to which you believe it should be handled. These paramedics initially, on the face of this article, seem to have done the right thing in a tough situation, but you'll need to make that assessment on your own. And of course, always follow your own local protocols and work guidelines, because those are the things that are going to protect you should you be sued in the event of an unusual situation like this cropping up. The second lawsuit story I found this week is a look at a firefighter paramedic in University Park, Texas, near the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And this individual was involved in several very visually and personally traumatic medical calls involving some pretty severe situations. And you can read the article to find a little bit more about what he experienced in the course of a couple of months on the job. And in fact, began having nightmares involving medical emergencies and needed to have some pretty strong counseling for post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, once this was officially diagnosed and the doctor cleared him to come back to work as a firefighter only, but not to regularly be required to respond on medical emergency calls, that at that point, the city fired him from his job. And he is suing to get his job back, basically wants to get his job back, but wants to not be required to regularly ride on medical calls because of his post-traumatic stress. Now, we've talked about stress. We did a whole Medicast Live episode on stress, and it's one of those things that we need to constantly be on the lookout for in ourselves, in our coworkers, and it's a job hazard. And, you know, as far as I'm concerned, this is a work-related injury, folks. This is a situation where this person became disabled as a result of work on the job. And he's willing to do work on the job, but he can't work in the original capacity to which he was hired. And I think it's incumbent on this service to bring this individual back in and offer them some opportunity to work and be productive. He's not looking for serious monetary damages. He wants his job back. And he's claiming he's being discriminated against based on disability that was actually occurred as part of his workplace and as part of his job requirements. And this is something that we need to stand up for and make sure that this guy gets what he needs in the way of the assistance and support from us and from the government to make sure that this doesn't happen to one of us. Because, you know, all we need is a couple of really bad, nasty calls in a row. You know, busload of kids getting, I mean, it could be anything. I know what my own nightmare would be, and I can only imagine what yours might be. But imagine that happening several times in a short period of time, and you find it increasingly difficult to recover from the stress involved there. Well, you know what? That's where you need to go ahead and make sure you're protected. And the best way to do that is to make sure that this guy and other people like him are protected in the workplace. So take a look at this story over at themedicast.com/blog. There you'll find the show notes pages and links to this and all the other news stories and things I refer to here. Finally, as I alluded to at the beginning of the show, happy EMS week, everybody. It is EMS week this week, starting on the 18th, which is yesterday. If you downloaded this show the first day it was available, but also runs throughout the week. And I found an article among many talking about what different agencies are doing in their communities for EMS week to celebrate EMS week. And I wondered what you are doing to celebrate EMS week. What are you doing to create some more educational opportunities in your community about what we do? That is one of the best ways you can get community support behind your agency, whether it's because you need new equipment, whether it's because you need more support so that you can lobby for better pay. These are all things that start with community backing and support. The community has very little idea on what we actually do throughout the course of a day. So bring them in. Show them your equipment. Let them climb in the ambulance. Let the kids come and learn about things like bike safety, injury prevention. Get a local store to contribute something to be raffled off, maybe a bicycle helmet or some knee and elbow pads and a helmet for skateboarders. These are all things you can do and make part of this initiative. Get one of those bouncy things you can get from the local hardware store that blows up and kids climb in it and jump around. Have a carnival-type atmosphere where kids come in and learn about all kinds of public safety issues. Local hospitals will contribute and bring people to show things. Your local health department has resources that can be made available to you. These are all things that you can make available in your station house and give people an opportunity to learn about what we do in EMS and certainly about how they can support EMS. And it starts with them getting to know you. And that's the way that when you go out and ask for public support, the public is more inclined to come forward and tell their elected officials that you indeed do need that public support. So take advantage of these PR opportunities. And it's maybe too late to plan for this year, but you know what? Start right now. I mean, like right now, thinking about what you can set up for next year and get it in place so that when next year's EMS Week rolls around in May, you have an EMS Week festival in your company or station. With the news completed, that means it's time for this week's tip and trick of the week. And this week's tip and trick of the week, I'm going to be focusing on the National Registry for EMTs computer-based testing program. This is something that has been around for a little over a year, probably about a year and 5 months or so. Started back in January 2007, and it is the method by which National Registry for EMTs in the United States requires all candidates to test now, both at the BLS and the ALS level, for National Registry certification. And this has taken the place of the old written test that was of varying lengths for different provider levels. Now the computer-based test is used. And there may be some confusion on exactly how this computer-based test is set up and specifically what you need to do to best prepare for it. So I thought I would talk a little bit about it. First off, computer-based testing is supposedly the most fair assessment that can be made in a written format, and I would consider computer-based testing a written format. It is still a test question in a written form that appears on the screen and you answer in most cases. So this is supposedly the most fair assessment of your knowledge level. It is used in many national certification programs, both in medical systems as well as in other national certifications like engineering, like teaching. All of these things occur via a computer-based test system like this, and they may add other aspects, like we have the skills testing, but this computer-based testing is in place. It is the same type of testing situation that I'm getting ready to take care of in my NCLEX, the nursing boards test, and it is set up in similar ways. One of the things that will help you the most, though, is being prepared for what to expect. In light of needing to have a good expectation and understanding of what your expectation should be, I thought I would ask for a listener to help contribute to that. And listener Matt was happy enough to get back to me the day after he took the test and let me know exactly what his experiences were like and to help prepare you. Now, even though he was testing at the EMTB level, it still applies to everybody as far as the EMTI and the EMT paramedic level, because this computer-based testing system is the same for everyone across the board, although the content of the questions may be different and the total amount of questions required to get a result may be different. It is still a similar system. So I'm going to go ahead and jump on into my interview segment with listener Matt on his experiences when he was testing for the National Registry computer-based test. Something to keep in mind, Matt is an existing EMTB in Utah, and he was heading home from college to go to California and where he lives, and he decided he wanted to try to get his EMT certification in California. California is a registry state, and so he had to go ahead and sign up and take the registry written test to pass that. And of course, as I said, that written test is now the computer-based test. I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and I'm here with listener Matt, and he just recently passed the National Registry EMTB test. So why don't you tell me a little bit about the process that you went through when you had to go into the test center, and we'll kind of talk a little bit about your impressions of the testing itself when we get to that.
Okay. Actually, going to the testing center, I mean, you get there and you have to present two different forms of government-issued ID, which I used my passport and driver's license. They were very excited that I had two proper forms of ID and that I was actually the lady in the comment. You would be surprised how many people come here to test that aren't actually them. So you show them the ID, they take your picture when you get there, they do a quick fingerprint in their computer there just to verify your identity there, have you sign electronically onto like the same thing you use like a supermarket checkout, and then that's the whole check-in process, and you're given an opportunity to go to the restroom. You have to keep one of the forms of identification with you the entire time. They scan your fingerprint every time you go into or out of the testing room. That's pretty much the entire process. It's very, very security heavy and kind of a little intimidating at first. But if you take a deep breath, you just realize that they're just looking out for our patients.
Well, not only that, but they're looking out for you, because it's not fair for you to have to, you know, to go and take your test on your own and then have somebody else circumvent the system and get in without doing that. So I completely agree with you. And that's very similar to how the nursing boards, the NCLEX test works. I think they use the same system.
Yeah. And in fact, there were other people there taking their nursing exam.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, how long did you took the EMTB exam? Is that correct?
Correct. Basic level.
And how long did that test last for you?
My exam ended up being 70 questions, and I only took 40 minutes to complete it.
Excellent. And we know you passed because you emailed me that you'd passed. But
yes.
Did you find the test very difficult or just about average in difficulty? How did you find that?
I was taking the National Registry test after having already gotten my Utah State certification. Because Utah isn't a national registry state, but I got that while I was in school, and now I'm home in California for the summer, so I wanted to get my California certification, and of course California is a national registry state, so I had to take the test. I forgot where I was going with that. What was the question you asked me?
Oh, that's okay. It's all right. You tested yesterday. You get a pass. I guess the question I asked was, you know, did you find the test very difficult, or did you find it easy?
Yeah, that's where I was going with that. Compared to the Utah test, it was significantly more difficult. But because of the adaptive nature of the test, I mean, it's designed, no matter how competent you are, to challenge you.
Right.
I don't know, have you read up on the adaptive nature of the testing?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So for me, it was challenging because there were quite a few scenario-type questions where I'm looking at these responses going, these are all – there's usually – like any multiple-choice test, there's one or two that you can go, that's funny. And then, you know, there's a couple left where you're really going, you know, either of those aren't too bad.
Right.
You know, and you kind of have to really sit there and think for a second. I know from my own personal testing experience that I tend to, when I first go through a test, go with my first instinct and then maybe second guess myself and change my response and get it wrong. And I know that I was right initially on my gut instinct the first time. before I started thinking too much. And I know that just from being a college student and having taken a lot of tests. Right. I know that's just how I test, and I just know that's what I do.
Well, that's not just you. I want to stop you there for a second, Matt, because this is an important thing for anybody that does any kind of testing. You know, as a training officer and instructor, I have to tell people time and again, and yet I still see erasure marks on papers coming in where they've erased the correct answer and circled something else. And I want to tell everybody, you've been through class and your brain has knowledge in there that may not be floating up as a definite answer, but a gut instinct is your brain saying, hey, I think this is what the answer is, but it's not sure enough to give you the definite answer. So you got to go with that initial knee-jerk reaction and not second guess yourself by reading, because then you're reading into the question most of the time.
Yeah, and when you start, they really aren't trying to trick you.
Right, right.
And so if you just start thinking too much, it's just going to harm you. Now, another important thing about the computer-based testing that I didn't realize until I got there is that because the test is adaptive, you cannot go back and review or change previous right. answers after you've answered the question.
And that takes one of my age-old techniques, which was, you know, if I had an answer I didn't know, I'd leave it blank and go, and invariably later in the test, I'd find something that would jog my memory or have the answer in the question.
Yeah.
You can't do that on this.
No, you can't. And that threw me a little bit. But that was just more to put a greater emphasis on going with my instinct initially and just continuing forward.
Excellent. Well, I think it's fantastic that you offered to share some of this information for the other listeners that are getting ready to test or maybe are just starting out in school and need to know a little bit about what to expect. I don't want this to go on too long because I know you've got things to do, but what would be the number one thing you would tell people if you were telling someone who had to go take the test tomorrow? What would you tell them about preparing or what they should expect and what they should be ready for?
I would definitely tell them about not being able to go back and change their answers, because I know a lot of people do that, like me, like you were saying, skipping answers you don't know and then going back later. That's one of my number one testing strategies normally, but you can't do that in this case. So I would definitely sort of apprise them of that. And in terms of review, I didn't go the route of purchasing any review books or anything. I made use of my course used the Brady Emergency Care Textbook.
Okay.
And they have a great website that has multiple choice questions and true false questions that you can use to review each chapter. And so I spent several hours the 2 days before just going through all of those quizzes to see what modules I needed to review a little bit, and then just kind of went over my notes. I personally don't really believe in cramming for a test because I would prefer that the test be more of an accurate reflection of my skill level and knowledge. So if I don't know it by the time I go to take the test or the night before, that I'm not going to know it the next day. And I'm probably going to be better served by getting a good night's sleep than trying to learn something that I don't know already.
Right.
So I would advise people to take advantage of the textbook websites because they put a lot of money and effort in developing those. And they're some of the questions are better than others, but you know, the more questions that you see that are, you know, in the same format that you're going to be asked on the test, the less uncomfortable you're going to be when you're sitting there in front of the computer in the testing center actually doing it.
That's very true. And I think that's been shown time and again in studies for people taking these certification tests at the national level in any career path, that the people that saw more test questions prior to the test, and I think the number usually rounds out about between 1,000 and 1,500 test questions, and that's why if you go online and look at those books are usually in that ballpark. They're at least 1,000 or 1,500 test question samples, because that's the number. That seems to be the magic number. Once you get past that number, that's what seems to be the thing that helps you the most once you get beyond those figures. And you're right.
Yeah.
You did exactly the right thing. It's the thing I recommend to students all the time. Divide and conquer. You know, if you have 9 units or 9 modules in your program, you know, maybe take back up 10 days and pick a module a day and go through the testing just like you did. And then the night before, you know, have a nice dinner, relax, watch some TV. If it's not there, it's not going to get in there.
Exactly. Yeah. Luckily for me, though, I did have the added confidence going into the National Registry test that I'd already passed all of my Utah testing. So I knew that, well, at least Utah thinks that I can help people. and hopefully the National Registry will agree. But so I think that helped calm my nerves quite a bit, too, because I know I'd already passed the Utah testing, which, although it wasn't, I didn't, the Utah testing is a conventional exam in terms of there's 100 questions and you can go back and look at your responses and that kind of thing. It isn't the adaptive, you know, artificially intelligent, out to get you kind of test.
Yep. Well, and, you know, it's definitely something to be prepared for. And I know everybody's going to appreciate hearing your take on taking the test, whether, and I think your application applies whether you're taking the BLS test or the paramedic version or the intermediate version of the test.
Absolutely.
Computer-based testing, that's how it works. And that's how it's aimed to test your knowledge. And so I want to thank you very much, Matt, for sharing this information with the listeners of the Medicast.
Sure, no problem. My pleasure.
I want to thank Matt again for sharing his experiences with the listeners here on the show. And I also want to go over a few points that he brought up and make sure that you guys hear what he was saying. First of all, this is designed to be a very difficult test for you. And I mean each and every one of you. This test is adaptive. And by adaptive, I mean that each and every question is based upon how well you have done on previous questions. In certain topic areas, it will gauge itself against items in that topic area, as well as gauging itself against how you've done overall on the test. And so when you do well and have a lot of knowledge on the test, it raises the difficulty level of the questions. It is trying to determine if you are competent to be an entry-level member of the EMS community at whatever skill level it is you are testing. And it will change the questions up as it goes, as it tries to narrow in on exactly what your competency level is. And so it'll eventually start getting narrower and narrower in its difficulty level and range, so that it'll give you questions that are a little bit harder than you can handle, and then occasionally a little bit easier than you can handle. And what that means is, no matter whether you're really knowledgeable or very unknowledgeable in your skill area, you will come out thinking that test was the hardest test you've ever taken. And it's important for you to remember that that's what it's supposed to be like. So don't use that as a gauge of whether you did well or poorly on the test, because it is not going to be an indication of that, because everybody has that feeling when they come out of these type of computer adaptive testing situations. It's not like in your regular class when some guy walks out of the test and gets 100 on every test, and he knows he got 100 on every test because he knew all the answers. And you might be the person that comes out of the test and just thinks you bombed it because it was very hard and very difficult, and you don't always get hundreds, and you struggle to get past that passing level. Well, it's important for you to understand that that guy who gets hundreds on every test, he's going to walk out of the computer adaptive test thinking that he failed, thinking that it was the hardest test he's ever taken, just like you do. So don't use that and have it ruin your day. That's the meaning of the computer adaptive testing situation, and it gauges and adjusts the competency and difficulty level of the questions to your ability level until it decides that it has tested you enough to say that your minimum ability level, your minimum knowledge level, is above the standard set by National Registry. And that's usually right around 70%. The other side of the coin is you can't judge based on the number of questions you saw or the time it took you to complete the test. Now, there will be a maximum time limit that you will have to complete the test. There are also a minimum and maximum number of total questions that you will be shown to see if you can pass the test. But some people will walk out the door with fewer questions than others, and other people will take longer to take the test than others, but that has no gauge on whether you passed or failed. It is merely the fact that the computer adaptive testing situation took a little bit longer to reach the point until they were 95% certain that you would meet minimum levels of entry-level requirements for your career field. And that's what this test does, and it's important that you understand some of these tricks and things going in. Also, remember, you have to have two forms of government-issued ID. And the website where you register for that information will have exactly what those are allowed to be. It'll probably be a driver's license, a passport, as you heard from Matt. There may be required that you have a birth certificate, but you need to know what those forms of allowable ID are and make sure you have them in your hand, or guess what, folks? You will not be allowed to test. So that's a little bit of a look at computer-based testing. I hope that helps those of you that are getting ready to test on passing your National Registry exam. And guess what, folks? That's going to wrap up this episode of the MedicCast. I want to remind all of you that you should head over to MedicCast.com and check out the links in the show notes over at the MedicCast blog. There's links on the page there at MedicCast.com to take you to the blog page where you can find the show notes, as well as links to all of the other shows in the MedicCast network, and also ways that you can sign up for the email newsletter. If you want to contribute comments, suggestions, corrections on anything I've talked about in this episode, make sure you get back in touch with me and let me know. You can do so by email at podmedic@mac.com. You can also call into the voicemail line at 941-306-3342. That's 941-30-MEDIC. And I will share your comments here with the listeners on the show. And it's a great way for all of us to contribute back to the MedicCast community. I'll go ahead and close out the show as I always do with some excellent PodSafe music. This week, a song from a friend of the show, Cody Prevost. Cody has a new song called Spin. I think I've played it before a few months ago, but I like it and I thought I'd play it again here for you. If you like what you hear, you head on over to Cody's website and let him know you heard it here on the MedicCast. You'll find links to Cody's website as well as links to use to purchase Cody's music from the iTunes store all in the show notes for the MedicCast episode here today. So without further ado, I'll leave you as I always do and say, I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, reminding everybody out there to remember scene safety, BSI.
Stop in an old cafe where everyone in town would start their day. Grab a nice cold drink at the pump and pay our weekend spend down at the lake. But something started telling me it's time to disappear. So one day I made the ties on my old Cavalier. Spinning down the highway, pedal down Chevrolet. Nothing standing in my way. Mama's home cooking and to see old friends. Grab a cup of coffee and catch up on the news. I can see nothing's changed in a minute or two. I start getting restless when I'm standing still. When the light turns green, I'm